I'm Dan Uster, chair of the Department of History. It's always a pleasure to welcome one of our own back to campus. Dr. James Gardner's remarkable contributions to the history profession make it a special privilege and honor to introduce him. Jim received his PhD at Vanderbilt in 1978, having earned a BA with honors in history at Rhodes College. From 1978 through 1986, he worked at the American Association for State and Local History, and then joined the executive staff of the American Historical Association. He is now Associate Director for Curatorial Affairs at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, responsible for the museum's collection, research, and exhibition development, as well as its relationship with Smithsonian affiliates and traveling exhibition services. James Gardner, as you can tell from this sketchy outline, has played a pivotal role in the interaction between museums and higher education. This also includes service as the president of the National Council on Public History, president of the Society for History in the Federal Government, and chair of the nominating board of the Organization of American Historians. He has also served on the board of editors for the Public Historian. Jim's publications include the AAM Guide to Collections Planning, Public History Essays from the Field, Documenting the Digital Age, and Ordinary People in Everyday Life, Perspectives on the New Social History. At a time when teaching history at the elementary and secondary levels of education is in some jeopardy, we might say once again, this time, partly because of pressures in testing, I think it's worth noting that Jim has also contributed to the History Teaching Alliance, the National Coordinating Committee for the Promotion of History, and National History Day. James Gardner has worked, has maintained his ties to Vanderbilt in ways that have benefited us. Most recently, he has worked with Mark Dauhaus, director of Vanderbilt's Office of Active Citizenship and Service, to create internships at the Smithsonian for Vanderbilt students. We're grateful to him for that, as well as for his willingness to visit with us today and present some material entitled A Mirror of America, Revisioning the Nation's History Museum. Please join me in welcoming James Gardner.
Out of my way here. Before I start, I've been trying to remember how long it's been since I've even been on campus, but there is a sort of element of nostalgia about being here for me. Either that or, I have to say, I keep thinking, the phrase that keeps coming into my mind is not nostalgia, but returning to the scene of the crime. For those of you who don't know Vanderbilt's history and know what, and some of you are too recent to know it, and some of you may just not remember, but when I was a graduate student at Vanderbilt, back in, I can't remember whether it was the spring semester of 73 or 74, but Vanderbilt had one of the really earliest public history graduate courses offered. This was actually before the whole development of the field of public history by that name, and it was called Historical Administration. Bill Alderson, who was himself a Vanderbilt PhD and had been archivist in the state of Tennessee and was director of the American Association of State and Local History, taught a graduate course on what was called Historical Administration. It's what we would now call public history, but there was that foundation that was important for me as my career developed in ways that were sort of unexpected. The other interesting thing, which is probably more in the coincidental kind of situation, is that 30 years ago this year, 1976, I was a graduate student here at Vanderbilt and was working as the graduate student on the American Historical Association's Program Committee for 1977. Dewey Grantham was the chair of the AHA's Program Committee that year, And as his graduate student, I worked for him on the program committee. And now, 30 years later, I'm back here again, and I'm on the AHA program committee again, and I feel like there's this sort of big arc, and as someone said, I've moved a little further down the table, but there's still this arc of connections in Vanderbilt and the AHA program committee, and now back again on the AHA program committee. So it's a sort of interesting moment to be here in that context. The title for my talk, comes from a book by two NMAH curators, Steve Lubar and Katie Kendrick. Actually, Steve's at Brown now, but they were both curators at the museum. The book was Legacies, Collecting America's History at the Smithsonian. It came out about 4 or 5 years ago. In that book, they proposed four different concepts of American history at the Smithsonian. First of these was the idea of the Smithsonian as a treasure house. This concept focused on the iconic objects that the Smithsonian is known to have, from the lap desk on which Jefferson drafted the Declaration of Independence, and the hat Lincoln wore the night he was assassinated, to the ruby slippers and Kermit the Frog. That whole range of sort of iconic objects that people associate with the Smithsonian. That's sort of one way of thinking about American history at the Smithsonian. The second one is the Smithsonian is a shrine to the famous, and it has certainly been that, beginning with the first collections that were to constitute the Smithsonian's history collections. In the late 19th century, the Patent Office transferred to the Smithsonian a bequest from George Washington's heirs that formed the foundation for today's history collection and today's history museum. But it began with that sort of great man concept. The concept encompasses, though, not just the great men, but the first ladies. Certainly, first ladies' dresses are both shrine to the famous and part of that treasure house. But we have, you know, Edison's light bulb, Custer's buckskin coat, even Evel Knievel's jumpsuit and motorcycle. A third concept is the Smithsonian as a palace of progress, a concept that's rooted in the 1876 Centennial Exposition collections, which came to the Smithsonian in dozens of railroad cars in the late 19th century and led to the building in 1881 of what's now known as the Arts and Industries Building on the Mall. This concept of a palace of progress encompasses not only power machinery, automobiles, and other staples of technology, but also medical and scientific achievements, information technology, and the rest. The fourth concept that Steve Lubar and Katie Kendrick proposed was the idea of the Smithsonian as a mirror of America, which is what I want to focus on today. Historically, the Smithsonian has long been or claimed to be a mirror of America, to reflect America and its people. There's no question about that. This is something that the Smithsonian has long claimed. What has been at issue throughout its history is sort of who's holding that mirror. And frankly, we've tended to see ourselves when we've held that mirror. The mirror of the America we see in that mirror is a fairly narrow sense of America. There are three moments that I think are key to understanding the Smithsonian's evolving role here in terms of reflecting America. First moment came in the early 20th century, when the Smithsonian first began to welcome the working class on Sundays. Sunday hours were first established in the early 20th century with the idea that it would give the working classes an opportunity to come and be uplifted. This coincided roughly with the opening, 1911, of the what was known as the new National Museum of Man, now the Museum of Natural History, across the mall from the original Castle and Arts and Industries Building. Now, while the new museum took on the world, the new Museum of Man took on the world, American history and culture moved front and center at the Arts and Industries Building. Now, while that history, that American history, was made available to all in that democratic gesture of Sunday hours, The history and culture actually belonged only to a few, the native-born Anglo-Saxon Protestant upper class. The Smithsonian reflected the experiences of America's cultural elite, their values and taste. Indeed, the early donors were largely prominent families, as well as the DAR, colonial dames, and other patriotic societies formed in roughly that same period. Now, the Smithsonian was not unusual in this regard. Indeed, the great public museums of the Western world were similarly established and developed by the dominant social classes, that is, by whites of European ancestry. Second moment in American history at the Smithsonian came after World War II, when the Smithsonian shifted to a more democratic, more inclusive history, inclusive at least of the white middle class. Perhaps more significant was the shift from the earlier focus on values and taste of the early 20th century to an interest in everyday life. And this came right after World War II. The exhibitions developed the interest of the curators at the Smithsonian after World War II were a precursor to the new social history's bottom-up approach in the 1960s and 70s. Although at that point it was more descriptive than analytical, and consistent with the 50s, emphasized conformity and consensus. Well, this was the context, this post-war interest in social history of one form or another. This was the context for building the History Museum that now stands on the Mall, the National Museum of American History. It opened in 1964 as the Museum of History and Technology. It was conceived quite bluntly as a Cold War monument. The intention was to celebrate the qualities that made the nation great and give the American public renewed faith in the future of democratic government. Its icons were the Star-Spangled Banner and a Foucault pendulum. They represented history and technology at that moment. It was not yet the National Museum of American History. It was the Museum of History and Technology. It set American achievements within a broader international or at least European context. In truth, it was more of a palace of progress than actually a mirror of America. Its agenda was clear from its organization. First floor focused on the history of science and technology. There was a road hall, a power hall, that sort of thing. Second addressed political and cultural history, including an exhibit on First Lady's gowns. And the third provided a mix of galleries focusing on specific taxonomic collections such as numismatics, ceramics and glass, that sort of thing, consistent with a traditional curatorial approach. The third moment came in the late 1960s under the leadership of Secretary Dillon Ripley, in which there came a renewed emphasis on the social value of the museum, the role it should play in repairing and strengthening the American social fabric, but in a fundamentally different way from that of our predecessors at the turn of the century. Indeed, the Smithsonian opened up its doors and engaged the public in new ways. Symbolically, Secretary Ripley turned the statue of Joseph Henry, the first secretary of the Smithsonian, turned the statue around. It had long faced the castle. It stood on the Mall facing the castle, and in a symbolic gesture, he turned it around to face the American public and the Mall. More concretely, the Folklife Festival premiered in 1967. In 1968, the Anacostia Museum, the first neighborhood museum, was established by the Smithsonian, and then in 1980, the Museum of History and Technology was renamed the National Museum of American History. As the name changed, so did the museum's focus, explicitly giving priority to the American experience for the first time and implicitly shifting the interpretive weight to social history. Now, there was more to this than just electing to pursue a new vision or direction. These changes responded to hard political realities. Arguably, the Smithsonian had little choice. The Mall was not isolated from the political and social turmoils of the 1960s and 70s, and the Smithsonian recognized that it must respond and change, must be more inclusive, or it would risk becoming irrelevant. With this new vision for the museum came a new vision of America. Less idealized, more realistic. Less descriptive, more about meaning. Not just bottom up, but also outside in. New points of view, new perspectives. Race, ethnicity, class, gender, all came to be part of the work of the staff at the Museum of American History. And with diverse voices came stories of conflict and inequality, injustice, and discrimination. Stories that critics derided as too negative, too divisive. Exhibits that reflected this shift included American Encounters, which was about New Mexico and Native American, Latino, and Anglo communities coming together. Field of Factory, Afro-American Migration, 1915 to 1940. A More Perfect Union, Japanese Americans in the U.S. Constitution, Information Age, Science in American Life, Parlor to Politics, Women in Reform in America, 1890-1925, and First Ladies, Political Role and Public Image, which was a significant reinterpretation of that ever-popular First Ladies gown collection, putting the First Ladies in the context of women's roles and the contributions of First Ladies to American history and to the presidency. All of those exhibits remained until about a year or so ago. Of those, only First Ladies, Political Role in Public Image, and Science in American Life remain intact, along with a little piece of Information Age. Field of Factory, which was installed 19 years ago, will be deinstalled beginning a week from today. But this was sort of the heyday of the museum and the point in which the museum was really moving forward with history. It wasn't a complete shift. Even as things changed, much remained the same. While synoptic exhibits were no longer a priority by the early 1990s, much of the old remained, notably numismatics, ceramics and glass, and the Road Hall. I'm happy to say they are now all gone. We no longer have those synoptic exhibits. Well, this all brings us to today, and there are new forces at work in the Museum of American History. The future's not entirely clear. Quite simply, September 11 and the aftermath have changed the context for the work we do. It isn't clear whether our core mission, which is to challenge our visitors' long-held understanding of American history, is politically feasible. Even before September 11, we were seeing a real push for more positive, more celebratory exhibits. After the Enola Gay controversy in the mid-90s, the problem was not so much censorship as self-censorship. Just before I arrived at the Smithsonian, the then secretary forced the museum to cut one section of an exhibit called Communities in a Changing Nation, The Promise of 19th Century America. The section that was cut and not allowed to be installed was on the Cherokee removal, and he deemed that too political to be allowed out. The exhibit, only part of the exhibit was installed and the rest has never been completed. But that was self-censorship. There wasn't a push from Congress, there wasn't a push from anybody. No one even knew that was being done other than within the Smithsonian itself. It was an issue of self-censorship. Now, post-September 11, I think there's more external pressure, more overt external pressure. Question is whether the public and our political leaders will see contested history as appropriate or as unpatriotic, preferring instead a celebratory view of the past, emphasizing national unity, and playing down our differences. The issue for us is whether our goal to remain to mirror a diverse and often contested past is still tenable. Can we do that? How do we resist those who expect uncritical, inspiring patriotism from the nation's history museum? How do we convey to the visitors that being patriotic does not mean love it or leave it, that commitment to our nation and its ideals includes recognizing that we have not always lived up to those ideals, that we've fallen short? How do we tell history like it really was rather than how we wish it had been? Contested history is not an easy sell in normal times. It's even more problematic in times of uncertainty like today, in a highly politicized climate. And to complicate matters even more, government funding for exhibitions has virtually ended, forcing us to be more attuned to funders' perspectives, needs, and expectations. Interestingly, and I'm happy to talk about this if any of you are interested later, the issue for us is not corporate influence. The issue for us is individual donors. Those are the most problematic for us. In this context of outside funding for exhibitions, scholarly isolation or detachment isn't really a viable option. So how do we position the Museum of American History within this context? How do we avoid outside pressure, and how do we keep focused on interpreting history? Well, I believe we are at a critical moment in the life of the museum and the Smithsonian. First of all, the Museum of American History is poised at the beginning of a decade of concrete change. If all goes according to plan, we'll close the day after Labor Day this fall for major renovation of the building. They closed about a year and a half. Major renovation, rethinking physically of the museum. But more important than physical renovation is the potential for more fundamental transformation. Not incremental change and exhibit here and there, but sweeping change. When you close down, renovate, you have an opportunity to really rethink things. Instead of patching up or fixing the museum piece at a time, as we've been doing for the last 40 years, creating a new one, not really physically so much as intellectually, not so much renovation as a new sense of the museum, a new direction. And I want to make it clear that I don't mean a change in basic mission. NMAH is first and foremost committed to history, stories of real people in real places told with real artifacts. Now that may seem like a given, but it's an important thing to state. We're a history museum, and that means our agenda encompasses both history and objects. And that makes for a rather complicated enterprise. But it still leaves much up in the air. For example, should the parts, the exhibits, add up to a whole? Should the Museum of American History present a comprehensive view of American history? Can we tell it all? Is it a realistic goal for us to do so? Is it even an appropriate goal for us? Should we present some sort of single master narrative, whether a traditional national one or some more radical notion, or should we present multiple narratives? Can we avoid a master narrative? Will whatever choices we make add up to a master narrative anyway? That's always a risk. The authoritative voice of the Smithsonian should never be underestimated with the public. Are we willing to sacrifice depth of coverage for breadth? In order to be comprehensive, we may have to sacrifice depth. Should the museum aim for the breadth of a textbook or the depth of a scholarly monograph, or some skillful balance of both, or something in the middle? These questions are tied to others about how the museum should work for visitors. Should the museum be tightly organized, like a book, in sequential order, each exhibit building on the previous, along the lines of the Holocaust Museum, which many people are familiar with? Or if not a single narrative, maybe one per floor? Or should we provide options and choices, multiple stories? Instead of a book metaphor, maybe a magazine. Our visitors, like magazine readers, choosing individual exhibits that stand on their own, starting anywhere they want. Well, from what we know about our visitors from various studies conducted over the years, people go there for many different reasons. Some go to explore American history, some to learn more about specific people, places, or events. Some come to celebrate the nation's past, some to be inspired, some to see specific objects or collections. And that means that the museum must work on different levels and for different kinds of visitors. We cannot assume that visitors will want to experience the museum in any single way, that they will follow any orderly path through the museum. Each exhibit, therefore, must stand on its own, must work, if encountered, without benefit of an introductory experience or exhibit, and outside any planned sequence of experiences. And we must provide both breadth and depth. We know that some visitors want a sense of the broad sweep of history, but they also want to connect with the past, explore in depth, not just skim the surface. In other words, a single narrative or organization won't work with our visitors. And practically speaking, a tight narrative organization is not good for the museum as an active, evolving enterprise. A restrictive scheme that institutionalizes a single approach or perspective makes future change problematic. We need to be careful not to lose flexibility in the pursuit of order. With too tight an organization or sequencing, any change becomes disruptive. Think about the difficulty of inserting a new chapter into the middle of a published book. It's a difficult proposition. My point with all of this, all of these questions and all of these issues, is that revisioning the museum is a complicated enterprise. And we have a lot of questions, a few answers, and much more to be done. What's been critical for us in sorting these things out, what's made this discussion different from that of the past, is a fundamental change in the terms of discussion. It's no longer just about history and about content, it's also about visitors. It's about public history. That's not always been the case at NMAH. Happy to discuss at some point with any of you who are interested the ways in which Museum of American History probably shares more with Vanderbilt than it does with other history museums in terms of the way it functions, in terms of its reliance on peer review and the ways in which it approaches its work. We're probably more like a university than we are like other history museums. And that has content and history has been the driving force in what we do. But we now recognize that we have to be advocates not only for history, but for visitors. That's critical if we're going to achieve our goal of engaging visitors in history. We can't simply build it and expect them to come. We have to work better as public historians. Well, returning to the post-September 11 political context for our work, an issue is whose history do we interpret? Whose vision of America do we interpret? A complex and contested past or a celebratory history of shared values and experiences? Politicization of history isn't new. As a profession, we've been grappling with it for, at the very least, a decade and a half. At least I've been dealing with it for a year and a half. It's been an issue far longer. During my years at the American Historical Association, I was on the front line in the culture wars, the intense battle for history, over history in the 1990s, over what history is, what role historians and historical scholarship should play in interpreting the past to the public, beginning with the Columbus quincentenary, then the Smithsonian's West as America exhibit, followed by national history standards, the Enola Gay controversy, all of that. The American Historical Association was involved in all of that. During the culture wars, history became a target of conservatives, and historians were demonized as part of a larger attack on multiculturalism, political correctness, and the rest of the so-called leftist political agenda. History's critics called instead for patriotic correctness. I want to make it clear that this was not just a debate, but a real war. It was not a civilized debate in many ways. During the culture wars, people took sides. There were demands and ultimatums. There were face-to-face confrontations, strategies and tactics, all of it. And it was became very personal. It became very ugly, with consequences for people's careers for years to come. And if you think it's all dead and buried, it's just been a couple of years since the Enola Gay issue came up again, with the reinstallation of the Enola Gay at the Air and Space new facility in Dulles. Well, but that debate, as difficult as it was over who owns history, wasn't then and isn't now simply a matter of politics. There was, and is, more than a right-wing conspiracy at work in the politics of history. I discussed this in more detail in my NCPH presidential address, and we're going to hit a few of the key points here. What we also ran up against in the 1990s and continue to face today apart from the political issues, the left and right, is the fact that the popular perception of history is at odds with where we are as a profession. The problem is more than radical revisionist versus conservative ideologues, but rather a tension or conflict between two very different views of history. The public's view versus that of as scholars and curators and historians. A view that focuses on great men and great events, the history of achievement, versus a more inclusive past, including ordinary people and everyday life. Objective truth or facts versus critical analysis, interpretation, meaning. A linear Whiggish view of the past versus a more complex view that includes both negative and positive. What we as scholars and curators see as mainstream, rooted in decades of teaching and research, appears radical and subversive because it's not celebratory, does not present history as a linear process of better and better, not the success story of American democracy. Because it is viewed as problematic because it presents a past that's complex and ambiguous, providing multiple perspectives, calling for critical thinking rather than easy commemoration of a glorious shared past. I'm going to move down a little bit here. So who's responsible for this situation, for this gap between our understanding of history and the public's understanding of the history? Well, to a significant extent, we are, as curators and historians. Traditional academic training does not prepare us to address the tensions between scholarly integrity and our responsibilities to the public. Most of us, to be frank, assume the validity of the historian's voice of authority and do not understand or even worry about the public's understanding of history. That's part of the history of who we are, part of the culture of historical scholarship. Even when we do more people's history, we're still largely specialists talking to other specialists about subjects that outsiders are not always interested in, and in language outsiders do not often understand. We function largely in a self-referential world, remote from everyday life. And I'm not just pointing the finger at academics. Harold Schramstedt has argued that the professionalization of museum work, and that includes public history, and the adoption of scholarly standards and peer review in the museum field has actually exacerbated the disconnect with visitors. When it comes down to it, even we public historians see ourselves as the authorities. And this is particularly the case when you're a public historian working at the Smithsonian. And we always believe we're the authorities. But when scholarship moves into the public arena, history becomes a more complicated enterprise. When history is interpreted in museums and historical organizations, the stakes are higher, and we have to negotiate, not simply claim authority. Not only do we have to recognize our institutional responsibilities, the mission of our institution, our obligation to the public trust, but also have to understand that the public feel they, not we historians, own the past. And that makes for tricky work, mediating between the authority of personal experience, memory, and meaning, and the authority of scholarship. It's particularly difficult at the Museum of American History. As the nation's history museum, the stakes are particularly high. What we present is seen as an official statement. Whether we claim it or not, it's seen as an official statement, a national validation, whether we intend that or not. For example, in 2002, we opened a small exhibition entitled July 1942, United We Stand. Now, this was conceived as a sort of anniversary show, the 60th anniversary of a World War II magazine campaign that focused on the image of the American flag with the owners of the Star-Spangled Banner. We do these periodic exhibitions. This would be a nice thing to do in 2002. Well, something happened between developing it and opening it, and that was September 11, 2001. And when it opened then in the spring of 2002, developed for one purpose, it was perceived in an entirely different context. It was seen as something entirely different from what it was intended to be. It was viewed as a salute to post-September 11 patriotism and flag waving. And it was never intended to be that, and it was not that if you experience the exhibit outside that changing political context. There's another side of the problem. One of the issues is that we as historians and curators don't fully understand the public, and the other side is that the public doesn't understand either the roles of museums or history and historians. The public does not understand that museums have shifted from preoccupation with the authenticity of artifacts to issues of significance and meaning. That the selection of artifacts for exhibition is itself a subjective act, a way of shaping perspectives, establishing point of view. Artifacts never simply stand as objective evidence. In Rory Rosenzweig and Dave Thielen's Presence of the Past, we're told that the public trusts museums more than their grandmothers, much more than they trust academics, much more than they trust books or anything else. They trust museums more even than their own grandmothers. Now, that all sounds well and good, but if you read Rosenzweig and Thielen, you find out that the reason the public trusts museums more than their grandmothers is because they think museums aren't trying to interpret history, that we aren't presenting ideas. We're just putting stuff out and they can see it. And that's really very problematic for those of us in history museums. That's not at all what we think we're doing. But apparently the American public thinks that's what we're doing. We're just presenting the stuff without ideas. Similarly, the public doesn't understand us as historians, that doesn't understand what history is and is not. One of my favorite quotations is from the Enola Gay hearings in 1995. Senator asked, is it really the role to interpret history rather than simply to put forward historical facts based on the validity of the fact and the historical value? I was a history major. In the days when I studied the text, it was essentially a recitation of fact, leaving the reader to draw their own analysis. This is the Enola Gay. Now, this was not a critique from a right-wing ideologue. That was Dianne Feinstein, Democratic senator from California, talking about history education at Stanford. And if she doesn't get it, what are the odds of the public gets it? We as curators and historians bear responsibility here. We want to share the end product of our work, but not the process. We haven't done a very good job of helping the public understand what history is and isn't. It isn't really surprising that they don't get it. As Alan Brinkley has put it, we teach comfortable myths in our schools and then expect visitors to understand when we turn around and challenge them with more sophisticated, complex interpretations. Well, how do we address this gap? Well, Ed Linenthal asserts that visitors need to hear different voices, not just one authoritative voice of the historian. They need to understand the tension between the detached voice of history and that of memory or the commemorative voice. They need to understand how historians make meaning from the past and how that intersects with memory and experiences. Unfortunately, that happens too rarely in our museums. He also, though, cautions against assuming that what the public needs is a simple story. He insists that complex stories can and must be told, that we must resist, quote, the insidious and dangerous attempts to sanitize or romanticize history that makes places of memory become places of forgetting. We cannot abandon our responsibilities as historians and curators, no matter how difficult it may be, no matter how politicized the context. Well, that tension over who owns history constitutes the context within which we at NMAH must make difficult choices about what history we will interpret. And it complicates our efforts to identify a central interpretive theme or direction for the museum. We have to be about more than just a mix of historical topics. At the heart of the museum in every exhibit must be a big idea or central theme. Core questions or issues. We need core questions or issues for visitors to grapple with. That's not an easy task at a museum of this size. First of all, we know that a theme cannot be simply about things or events or ideas. It must be about people. We know that to engage our visitors, we must present the past on a human, even intimate scale. Not a history of only famous individuals or even anonymous groups or aggregates, but one that demonstrates human agency. That's about real people dealing with real life, making choices. We have to populate the past in order to engage the public. Second complication is that we are a national museum, and any overarching theme must be broad enough to encompass the diverse experiences of the American people and the multiple political and ideological perspectives that our visitors bring to the museum. But being a national museum does not mean that we are obligated to tell a celebratory story. We have a responsibility to help our visitors understand that our history is diverse and contested. Rather than try to concoct a simple story of shared experiences, we need to share many stories from multiple points of view, exploring the complexity and richness of the American past, seeing difference in contest as a strength, not something to be plastered over with an idealized story of shared values and goals. In other words, we have an obligation to interpret history, not just present the past as we wish it had been. And third, a central theme must work on different levels. It must be simple enough to be stated clearly and concisely. This is public history. Clearly and concisely in no more than a single question or sentence, and yet subtly complex, encouraging diverse perspectives and interpretations. A theme that requires more explanation on the front end will not engage visitors, but simplicity should yield to complexity throughout the larger museum experience, and that's a challenge for us. We know that history is far more complicated than can be captured in a label, a historical setting, or an exhibit. But it's important that our visitors, the visitors to our exhibits, appreciate the complex forces that have shaped and continue to shape America. As our mission statement says, we're committed to presenting challenging ideas about the American past. So what have we come up with at NMAH? Within those parameters, our focus is on the question, what is it meant to be an American? Now, note that that's a historical question, not what does it mean to be an American, which is one of the unfortunate things that the administration tends to say, but what has it meant to be an American? We ask, how have individuals and communities in the past defined themselves as American? Has there been a single American identity, or have there been many? Early in the 19th century, Alexis de Tocqueville framed the question in a letter to a friend. Picture to yourself, if you can, a society which comprises all the nations of the world, people differing from one another in language, in beliefs, and opinions. In a word, a society possessing no roots, no memories, no prejudices, no routine, no common ideas, no national character. What is the connecting link among these so different elements? How are they welded into one people? But while de Tocqueville asked how the revolutionaries y pluribus unum might be achieved, others questioned whether such a melding was possible. In the early 20th century, President Theodore Roosevelt thundered, "There's room here for only 100% Americanism, only for those who are Americans and nothing else." And then later in the century, from a very different perspective, came Ralph Ellison's answer, "America is woven of many strands. I would recognize them and let it so remain. Our fate is to become one and yet many. It's not prophecy, but descriptions." In other words, what is meant to be an American may at first glance seem a simple question. We think our visitors will see that as a simple question. And they may assume it's about shared values and traditions. But once you explore and once you go into it, it's really more complex. It's not about a single American identity, but about the multiple ways being American is played out. How has who we are as individuals, our age, class, ethnicity, gender, language, nativity, race, religion, sexuality, abilities, and disabilities differentiated us as Americans? How have difference and the construction of difference shaped the American experience? How have our individual and community identities overlapped with, reinforced, or subverted national identity? Have we created one out of many? What is it that makes us a nation? How have we expanded and contracted our notion of citizenship to include and exclude different groups? What has been the price of national unity? What we are particularly interested in are the intersections of identities, individual, community, and nation. The intersections that are brought to life by Jewish immigrant Israel Fine's Star-Spangled Banner Centennial scroll cover, that brings together his immigrant, Jewish immigrant background with his newfound patriotism. World War I era Navajo flag pattern blanket, or African-American Civil War veteran Christian Fleetwood's Medal of Honor. Our goal is not to articulate shared values or experiences, but a richer, more complex past. In other words, getting back to the title of this, to be a mirror of America. This thematic focus provides a broad umbrella under which we can develop new exhibits, programs, and other activities. Our goal is quite simply to foster that discussion in every exhibit and program, explicitly or implicitly. We believe that this is an important role for the Museum of American History to play, providing historical depth and understanding in a unique setting where Americans from all walks of life can join in a discussion about the nature and meaning of Americanness, about what it is meant to be an American. Now, this concept of the museum is grounded in a role that national museums around the world have long played as vehicles for building or reconstructing national identity. According to a recent white paper by the Smithsonian's Office of Policy and Analysis, national museums, for both inclusion and exclusion, have always played a role in defining who is part of the nation, what ideas and issues can be discussed, who benefits from museum programs, and whose voices matter. But the museum approaches this role in a different way from the Smithsonian of the late 19th and early 20th century. We look not to sharing values, but we look to more recent efforts by national museums to consciously reposition themselves as civic spaces for such discussion, and to relinquish, and which they relinquish, their traditional authoritarian roles. For example, the new Australian National Museum was developed as a reflective space where visitors could consider issues against the backdrop of their history, where scholarship and research provides a context for informed public debates that can't be had elsewhere, where the rules of engagement are grounded in respect for multiple points of view. NMAH wants to play that role, to serve as what's called the new town square, to be, as Elaine Gurian puts it, a safe place for unsafe ideas. Now, that's all easier said than done. What's the right mix of exhibits to provide the multiple perspectives on what it's meant to be an American? Political reality, when you're on the mall, is every group wants visibility, wants an exhibit. But how do we deal with difference without setting apart those who are different? How do we avoid developing exhibits about those people for those people? So far, I think we've successfully avoided that pitfall. For example, A More Perfect Union, which is about Japanese Americans and the U.S. Constitution, works really on two levels. It straddles the tension between cultural identities and larger American stories, using the story of one group, Japanese American internees, to get at larger issues of being American. And while the focus is Japanese Americans, the exhibit is really about all of us, about difference and what it means to be an American. But can we accommodate every group in that way? We're a big museum, very big museum, but still we still have limited space. And every group wants and deserves a prominent exhibit. We can't do it all. How do we set priorities? Well, as we prepare for renovation, we're deinstalling most of the museum, taking it down. And that means nearly every exhibit with a minority focus is being closed. More Perfect Union is closed. Field of Factory closes a week from today. American Encounters closed a year or two ago. As we look to reopening, maybe it's time for a new direction. If we are to be a mirror of America, shouldn't our goal for the future be to integrate minority experiences across the museum rather than treating them separately? We've already begun this. We're committed to making difference a part of every exhibit, not some exhibits, but every exhibit. Opened an exhibit a couple of years ago called America on the Move, which I think is really does a wonderful job of integrating issues of difference. It took a piece of rolling stock, a train, and that had been there as an example of technology, and it's now interpreted in the context of African-American educator by the name of Charlotte Hawkins Brown, who rode the train out of Salisbury, North Carolina in the 1920s, fighting Jim Crow. And she was thrown off the train in the 1920s, I think in Memphis, actually, because of her protest. But it's now a piece of social history and about how even simple decisions about transportation have complex implications for our society and our culture. But if we do this integrating difference in minority experiences in all the exhibits, does that mean losing the depth that exhibits like A More Perfect Union provided? How do we balance the broader story of diversity with the need to explore in depth the distinctive histories of individual groups? Can we provide breadth and depth both? How do we avoid dividing the museum up by racial ethnic group, which is one direction we can go with specific exhibitions? How do we avoid that, but without going the other way, in which we end up with race and ethnicity, we end up with tokenism in larger historical exhibits? Can we truly integrate historical experiences into narratives that, to be honest, assume as default a Euro-American male voice? How do we change that? And how do we expand, explore difference in a broader sense? Not just race and ethnicity, but age, abilities and disabilities, class, gender, language, nativity, religion, sexuality. And perhaps even more importantly, can we move from concerns with difference and diversity with other to simply explore American history in all its richness and complexity? Should we really be that concerned with difference? And exhibits are only the most public piece of our work. The core of what we do is collecting and research, and that is the foundation on which our exhibitions are based. How do we address difference as we shape the collections, for example? When I joined the museum, I found that collecting the history and culture of people of color was confined largely to one unit. But shouldn't it be on the agenda of every collecting unit? That requires really thinking about collections in significant ways, and it requires staff to work in new ways. It's a real challenge for us at American History. It requires a level of collaboration and cooperation we're not accustomed to. And to further that, we just reorganized the entire curatorial divisions to move away from a compartmentalization of race in one division and to make it the responsibility of all. The next challenge is changing behavior, which is going to be a real problem. It's critical. We have to... If we maintain that exploring difference in exhibition is central, if we want visitors to see issues of identity and difference is at the heart of American history and being American, we have to do more than just present that as a public face. It has to be part of our daily work, reflected in our collections, our collecting, and in our research. Now, all of this becomes significantly more challenging for the Museum of American History with the development of more specialized museums. Not just the National Museum of the American Indian and the National Museum of African American History and Culture, but also the proposed Museum of Women's History, the proposed Latino Museum. There are a number of other proposed specialized museums waiting in the wings. These museums are being established to tell specific stories from particular points of view, to focus on difference. How do we fit in? What's left for us? How do we avoid ending up the National Museum of White Men Who Travel on the Land and in the Water? You know, we've already lost air to another museum, and we've lost the post office. So we could be the National Museum of White Men Who Travel on the Land and in the Water, but not in the air. Even if we can deal with this intellectually, which I think we can do, arguing for an integrated role for the Museum of American History, how do we deal with it physically? I don't know whether many of you have noticed, they've announced the location of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It is literally across the street from the National Museum of American History. We have to face the likelihood that once that museum is built and opens, that visitors standing on the sidewalk will look up and say, "Oh, black museum, white museum." How do we deal with that? how do we convey the interactions that we plan and are already working on with between the two museums when people are simply making a judgment standing on the sidewalk? It's a real challenge, and one that we really don't have any solution for, but one that we're going to have to face. Well, ultimately, what is Museum of American History's distinctive role? We have a complex mix of issues and obligations to address. There's no easy solution on any of this. Future will doubtless be rocky and even treacherous. All I can say right now is that we're working on it. We're trying to navigate the challenges of doing public history and make the National Museum of American History truly the nation's history museum. I want to conclude, this is my other favorite quote. I use these two quotes, the Dianne Feinstein and this one, all the time. This is a story that was recounted a few years ago in the New York Times. Quote, in a tense political climate with budgets being cut sharply and Congress watching every other government program like a hawk, the Secretary of the Smithsonian felt he had no choice but to insist that the head of one of the institution's division keep the controversial views of a prominent researcher on his staff quiet. After all, he realized, the researcher's work could be perfect fodder for ill-wishers who would seize upon it as proof that the Smithsonian was cut off from the mainstream of American thinking. And a skeptical and peevish Congress would have an open invitation to squeeze the institution's budget yet again. Far better not to publish this work, the Secretary urged in a letter, lest it be read in Congress by any representative of the numberless constituents whose dearest religious beliefs are so wounded in a government publication. The point of this was that this wasn't a recent controversy. This happened over 100 years ago. This was a story in 1897. And I think as historians, we at the museum take heart that we've survived the politics of our work before and will probably do so again.
Dr. Gardner has already volunteered to address any questions that you might have. But before he proceeds, I just want to invite all of you to stay for a reception, which will be held out in the lobby. So.
No questions? Yes, Paul.
How do you evaluate the more focused mission of the Holocaust Museum? Do you think it's effective?
Of the whole?
Of presenting not a very sad and horrible story.
We, you know, the issue for us in terms of this issue of contested, you know, we tend not to end an exhibition on a, criticizing the United States, but our issue is we want to deal with that it's not linear, that there are steps forward and there are steps back, there are corrections and there, and that everybody doesn't agree on everything. Now, you know, does that mean that we end up, you know, that everybody leaves depressed because the nation's going to hell and always has been? No, it doesn't happen that way. I mean, you know, we are a museum, it is the public, we do want people to get a sense of the nation, but we don't think it's a bad thing for them to understand that it's been contested and we fought a lot and disagreed a lot. We think that's a pretty good, that's a good history and not something we should be, should see as a problem. I think we're doing a better job of that now than we've done in the past. Well, some exhibits better than others. This one, America on the Move, which is about transportation, and you would think would be not one that would deal particularly with issues of contested meaning in the past, actually does a wonderful job with the things like, you know, going into Jim Crow and Pullman porters and machinists and all of that on the railroads and really looking at the complexity of that experience. And we've done a lot of that throughout that exhibit of really trying to open it up, dealing with gender in the suburbs of Chicago in the 1950s and differences in gender roles and how things evolved in the 50s. I think we've done a better job there than we have. We have an exhibit that I did not mention and try not to ever mention called, The Price of Freedom, Americans at War. which is an example of, the title is an example of an individual donor gone wrong. The exhibit is not about the price of freedom. The exhibit is about war, and it's about wars that are only occasionally about freedom. They're often about taking land from other people. They're about power. They're about all sorts of things, and indeed the exhibit deals with that. Unfortunately, it's the context of it is a title that an individual donor insisted on as the title for that exhibition. It's an embarrassment to me, you know, that this exists that way. But the exhibit actually deals, I think, does do a good job of dealing with war as this is somebody who wanted a celebratory exhibit. Well, you know, my wife goes through that exhibit, and she, you know, it reinforces every anti-war bone in her body because it's about people dying and people being dismembered and amputations, and I mean, it's really a sort of bloody exhibition in many ways, and not about their heroes in there as well, but there's a lot of loss, and I think it's a good balanced exhibit in that. It just has this god awful title. Yeah.
I have two questions. The first is whether the long-standing exhibitions like Bond Factory will, once they're dismantled, remain online, accessible in some way that way. And second, you tantalizingly referred to the difference between support from corporations and that, and you've just given an instance from individuals. Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Field the Factory, one of the unfortunate things about Field the Factory is it's old enough, it was pre-web, so I don't think there's much available about it on the web. In fact, we just had, we brought back Spencer Crew, who was the lead curator on it, for a program last week to talk about it, because it was, for those of you who don't know about Field the Factory, it was an important sort of landmark exhibition, not just for the museum, but for history museums generally, in terms of taking on a subject like African-American migration, and in terms of dealing with the issues of whether there are collections to support that. There were some interesting choices made and decisions made about how to produce that exhibit in order to make it happen. So it's not, there isn't a sort of continuing presence for it, which is one of the problems. The issue, people tend to, from outside, tend to think the big issue is undue corporate influence on exhibitions. There is basically no federal money for exhibitions at the Smithsonian anymore. So everything has to be raised outside. Now, when we say there's no federal money, all the staff are paid for on federal money, but the cost of producing the exhibition is not, they used to all be paid for by out of federal dollars. No longer are they. I think we received our last federal support maybe 5 years ago for an exhibition. So everything is raised privately. Corporations tend to understand what's at stake. They may ask for things, but you can tell them no. And they understand what can happen if there's bad press. They understand, they have, most of the corporations we're dealing with have a history of giving. They understand what it means to be a donor. They understand that it's to their best interest that we do our job and they do theirs, and that they not meddle in what we do. We also tend to approach corporations after we've decided exactly what we're going to do. And it's basically, here's what we're going to do. You're interested in supporting it? Good. If you're not, we'll move on. Private donors, individual donors, for us, for one thing, have tended to come in and say, I have money and I want you to do an exhibit on this topic, like the price of freedom. And then you have difficulty talking them out of what they already hear, what they already envision. The other thing is what is sometimes referred to as venture philanthropy, which are these donors, they tend to be new money. They don't have a record of philanthropy, of giving. And so they basically come in and just tell you what, they see this as an investment. They're not making you a gift. They're investing in your museum, and they're going to manage that investment by staying involved in it. And it's a really, when you run into that sort of thing, and it's more, a lot of the new money that's out there is of that nature, and it's really difficult to manage. They require more management to keep them out of your work than the corporations. Corporations seem to understand what's going on and what the stakes are, and will, you know, it's not to say they don't ask for things, but you can tell them no. The individuals, you can't tell no. They don't ever hear it. They don't understand it. They have their own view of the world. They have lots of money, and they expect you to do it. And they are our worst nightmare, are those the wealthy individuals who come into the museum with ideas. They are a nightmare. Rebecca. All the new exhibits, any new exhibits will be paid for private money.
But, and you're expecting that it will be mostly corporate? That it will be mostly corporate?
We hope it will be. At this point, it's not. We're still dealing with the same donor. The donor that insisted on the price of freedom as the name is an $80 million donor. And that's only that $80 million pledge, and that's only $16 million of his donation. So we're still dealing with him. We're meeting, you know, last Wednesday I was meeting with the team who are gingerly approaching another exhibit. One of the big exhibits that we're, the next sort of big exhibit that we will do, which won't open in 2008 when we reopen, but in 2009, is basically conceived as an introduction to American history. It's that way. It's sort of the successor to Nation of Nations from the 70s, to these big sort of landmark exhibit that help people sort of understand American history and give them that overview, and then they sort of move off into other exhibitions. So, you know, dealing with him, you know, what's his, what are we dealing with in?
So you're sort of sizing. I'm trying to get at the process of this.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me as though you could get your ideas and you try to match them with failures. Would that be?
See, the problem is the donors say, I want to do, he says he wants to do this exhibit. This is what he wants to do. So the issue is trying to convince him that the approach that we're taking is one that will meet his needs and will be appropriate for him, but will be appropriate for us as well. But it's in his gift agreement that he's paying for this exhibit, so we now have to figure out how to live with that because he's, and you need to understand that when I'm talking about outside funding for exhibitions, I'm talking about huge money. The America on the Move exhibit, we had $3 million in federal money, $35 million exhibition. So we're talking huge sums of money, 30, 35. The Price of Freedom exhibit was $16 million. So these are big investments, big ticket items. They're not, and we're not talking about small gifts, we're talking about really big gifts.
Does it make you nervous knowing that you're going to close for a year and a half and not know what the animal is when you reopen it?
Yeah, it makes me, full disclosure, I'm afraid we're not reopening in 2008. I'm afraid that it's going to be really easy to close down and get this started, and it's going to be nearly impossible to get the place reopened. Unfortunately, other people seem to be just sort of blindly assuming that will happen. I think there's every reason to think we'll close for a year and a half and open in 2 or 3 years or something. Because there's an enormous amount of work that has to be done between now and spring of 2008. And I think if we reopen in 2008 as planned, we're going to have a lot of empty galleries. There won't be anything in many of the galleries. We'll still be in development for a number of exhibitions. We're going to be putting traveling shows into empty galleries. I'm hoping we'll even have galleries. I'm afraid they won't even be carpet and lighting. It's a huge, I think we're not in a good position for this.
Does it make it more difficult that there is no, I don't want to say it this way, but I'm going to say say anyway, corporate philosophy as to, you know, exactly what you're doing, what the purpose is. Seems like that's a debate that needs to be settled before you can start planning.
Yeah, the issue is there is actually my part of the museum, which is, and you know, it's again, it's a big museum. I mean, I have 115 or 120 staff. We pretty much know where we want to go, and there's real consensus there. I think most of the rest of the museum shares that with us. Director, maybe not so much, and I can't go into that in detail, but then we have a board. We have an advisory board that has their own agenda, which is very problematic, and has a chair who simply doesn't want to hear anything else. And then we have donors. So, yeah, I mean, there's not that, there. You know, if we could do our work, we know where we're going with it. It's just that we keep running into these other people who think they know better. The chair of our board, for example, thought that the museum should have an Introduction to American History exhibition that would be literally inside the front door. There'd be no, I mean, museums have to have public space. You have to have a place to mill around, place to find your family. But he thought the exhibit should, you should walk in the doorway and be in the exhibit, and it should take up the entire, you know. And said, you know, we know about how to develop exhibits and how museums work. And he said, well, but, you know, I think I'm right on this. And you're dealing with that kind of mentality. It's an impossible situation. Yes. Hi. You want to bring up an old exhibit, don't you? That you worked on. we've actually tried to resurrect that one several times, but so far it's dead in the water. This book, Legacies, Collecting American History at the Smithsonian, was originally supposed to be an exhibition that was to mediate between what public knows and thinks about history and what the museum and the Smithsonian knows and thinks about history and how it does its work. And it was really to try to open up and say, you know, here's the way we think about history and here's why we have the stuff we do. And the reality is, you know, those four concepts, we're all four of those all the time. I mean, we're a Palace of Progress, a Mirror of America, a Treasure House, and a Shrine of the Famous. We're actually all of those. They're just, you know, different sort of angles on that one on the one museum. And the idea was that this exhibit would be sort of one of the terms which I didn't know about, wayfinding, is a sort of museum term. And we talked about physical wayfinding, that people have difficulty in the museum figuring their way through the museum physically, trying to figure out where the hell anything is and where the restrooms are and the escalators and all that. And that's one sort of orientation thing. But the other issue is this whole thing of intellectual wayfinding. How do they understand what history and history museums are about and work it into their own sort of knowledge and cognitive abilities? How do they adjust to that? That when you just expect them to come in off the mall in the summer and go whap into an exhibit that deals with Japanese American internment and the Constitution and all that, you know, they tend to just go, oh, okay, I don't, you know, and they back away. How do you sort of mediate? So intellectual wayfinding and physical wayfinding. Haven't been able to resurrect that. I really think it's an important concept. So the new introductory exhibition, this Introduction to American History, Katie Kendrick, who you work with, Katie will be the lead curator on this. So my guess is I'm going to see a lot of her ideas that she and Steve Lubar and all worked on begin to find their way in there, that we use it as a way not just to get into American history, but to get into the idea of what history is and isn't and all that. So, yeah.
Jim, yeah. Where do you see sites in the second decade of the 21st century? Will it exist or would it...
Sites? Yeah, sites, Smithsonian Institution Traveling Exhibition Service. It's a bigger part of our work than it's ever been. We are doing more exhibits, traveling exhibits. We have like 12 out now, maybe, or some of them are coming back. We actually, one of the answers to this issue about depth and breadth is to think about a gallery spaces. We want to integrate African American history, for example, throughout the museum. But we need to do African American history exhibitions. So maybe what we have is a changing gallery where we develop an African American exhibit and it stays for a year and then travels around the country. And then the next exhibit is on Latinos and we develop it and move it out. Another one is on disability studies, and we actually use sites as a way to sort of take some of the pressure off of us, a way for us to develop exhibits that give donors some more visibility, and it gives us a way to do more of the in-depth stuff that we can then take out across the country. So sites for us is pretty critical, that whole traveling thing, because it enables us to keep producing. Otherwise, you kind of run out of real estate. You know, you fill everything up, and it costs $30 or $40 million. You're not changing it anytime. The price of freedom will be there. I think it's a 40-year gift agreement. It's going to be up to, I'm going to be dead and gone when this thing comes down. And when you ask somebody for $30 million, they want it to stay up forever. But sites, traveling shows give us an opportunity to take things out and experiment. Yes. Against the web, which is not that I'm against the web. We, a couple of years ago, had a sort of symposium, an internal thing for Smithsonian for the American history, and we brought in executives from all these IT companies, who would advise us on sort of what are the latest techniques, and we'd tell them about what we were doing, and we talked about network knowledge and how all the knowledge would connect in cyberspace or whatever. And we really, they were doing their bit, we were doing our bit. And one of my staff gave a presentation on collections and collections on network knowledge and how you've got the object, you've got, it connects electronically to the documentation, the records, it connects to the scholarly article that was published, it connects to, oral histories, it connects to, and all of these things, and then it connects to other collections. And she uses an example, and she had a big PowerPoint. She showed it what's called a Peggy. Now, a Peggy is a little round tin box about this big from the turn of the century. It had a post on the end. You opened it up, had a little post in it. And the point of the Peggy, the peg inside the box, was that you put your chewing gum on it, and then you closed the box and kept it. And that was the way you preserved your chewing gum. And she used it as a trivial object and said, here's the Peggy. And then she talked about the collection's records. And then she connected it to advertising. We have advertising collections on Wrigley and all of that. We have photographs, all of these sorts of things. And then at the end, she had this elaborate PowerPoint. At the end of it, she said, and if anybody's interested, I've got the Peggy at my table. And during the break, I'd be happy to show it to you. All of the IT people had to go see the Peggy. Now, they're the people who are supposed to be telling us that virtual is better. Even they didn't want it. I mean, they saw it in more detail than you could ever see it with the eye in this blown-up PowerPoint. Even they wanted to see the real thing. So there's a sort of limit to the way in which the web addresses those issues. People still want to really see things. And so I don't think the web deals with that. All right. We are, however, doing new things, talking about teaching, that sort of thing. We do electronic field trips, which are really this wonderful way to reach millions of school students at once, we're going that direction rather than curriculum. We don't think teachers are probably using the curriculum we send them, but we know with these electronic field trips that we're hitting a lot of kids at one point, at one moment, with a discussion about a topic. We did I think our biggest one was, we have a 50th anniversary Brown versus Board of Education exhibition, separate but unequal. And we had on the anniversary, on the 50th anniversary of the Brown decision, we had electronic field trip linking schools across the United States. We had two, 3 or 4 million, I don't even remember how many students at one moment participating in this via electronic communication. So there, it's more on the education side than it is on the exhibit side. What was your other question?
Just whether the physical layout of the museum has changed.
The physical layout will change. There is some difference of opinion about whether or not this is a good thing or not. I think it's kind of an interesting concept. The design, I think it really is an interesting concept. One of the things we know people come to, I mean, let's face it, we're called the nation's attic. People expect to see lots of stuff. They want to see lots of stuff. Well, there's going to be sort of a tension in the new museum. The center core that you enter in will be just about stuff. It will be basically glass cases of open storage, and there'll be lots of wonderful things, but not about interpretation, not about meaning and storage, just lots of stuff. And it'll be that opportunity to understand that the museum has a diverse and rich collection. And then you go into the wings and you go into the interpretive exhibition. So we're trying to sort of create a tension between that perception of the museum as the nation's attic and then the larger interpretive stories, which will be in the wings. So there is a sort of rhythm.
Let's continue this over some food and drink outside. Join again and thank you.